Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Hello, and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine, and here's Alex Stewart.
Hello, Joe.
Here's Seb Stafford-Blore. Jokes, he's not here for the intro because he's lazy, I think. But anyway, today's episode is a second parter to last week's, where we discuss footballing dependencies. This time we take things a little more broadly, and we look at strikers, particularly Harry Kane, and players like Jamie Vardy, Sergio Aguero. We talk about goalkeepers, Manuel Neuer, Alisson, Ederson, and also we talk about wing-backs or full-backs, and some confusion over the terminology there as it relates to Seb's mind. What else did we talk about, Alex?
I think that's a pretty good summation of it. Obviously, there's a greater degree of complexity than you've sketched out, but sure, it's a good place to start.
Sometimes I just like to cover everything and then throw it over to you to just see
just
what
to leave
he'll say.
Me dangling off the edge of a cliff. Yeah,
absolutely.
It's nice. It's good.
As Alex dangles there, I'll just remind you that keen football fans and readers and observers and just people adjacent to the game, if you're alive and you exist and you listen to this podcast, then I think you'll like The Athletic. If you visit theathletic.com/TIFO, you can get some kind of great deal, and I genuinely can't remember what it is at the moment, but I promise you, that's because it's so good that it has boggled my mind. It might be £1 a week, actually, which, for the quality and the volume of the material that you will have access to, that is an incredible deal. Material such as, Alex?
So I've recently been, and I know why you've done that, because you're trying to trip me up or catch me out, but actually, I've been reading Ryan S. Clark's work on the Seattle Kraken, which is the new expansion franchise in the National Hockey League in America. So,
Well, great work on making it as broad as possible and of interest to people there. there's also football stuff, Premier League, of course,
Do you not think it's fascinating, though, how a team can just start out of nothing and have to put an entire roster, coaching staff, head coach and everything together and build from the ground up?
Yeah, I mean, it does give me hope. It's really the American dream, isn't it?
It's amazing. Yeah.
I wonder how much money that cost, did they say?
I can't remember reading that because I've been looking at how they're putting their roster together, but it's got to be like 100, 150 million, surely.
Yeah. Easy it's pocket change. Money. No problem. I'll do it this weekend, hey? Winning the Hockey Cup, whatever it's called.
Stanley Cup, yeah.
In memory of Stanley. Yeah. That's the intro now.
My therapist was called Stanley.
Okay. Okay, where better to start than with Mr. Harry Kane? And Seb, I'm going to come to you for Mr. Harry Kane because I believe he's broken both legs.
Injured both ankles is the version I'd heard, Joe. But yeah, he has problems in both legs and will be out. Jose Mourinho
what happened?
Says. Well, just two fairly innocuous challenges, actually. Like the first, there was one from Thiago, which wasn't great, but, you know, hardly malicious, and then there was a little bit of a tangle which seems to have accounted for the second ankle. But yeah, we know that Kane has weak ankles already, and for what seems like the fifth season in a row, he's going to miss a significant chunk because of an injury in that area. Areas, actually.
I was going to ask, I haven't paid particular attention to Kane's injury record, but now that you say it, does mm-hmm. he does seem to be injured a fair amount. And, you know, in the context of today's conversation, part two, football dependencies, this is something that Tottenham come up against pretty much every year, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like Christmas, but just bad. Like, it's kind of... it's
Christmas.
Just what, yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, not this year.
No. What a great time.
It's all right this year. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so obviously... last year, it was actually a torn hamstring, so it's slightly different. But he, if you remember, going back to, for instance, the Champions League quarterfinal first leg against Man City, he injured his ankle there, and that was the injury which almost kept him out of the final. Season before, I think a collision with Asmir Begovic at Bournemouth, in which he kind of, I think Begovic landed on his ankle and, you know, caused Kane to roll it. Basically, I with the kind of the very vague understanding I have of physiotherapy, once you injure your ankle, never really properly recovers. The joint is kind of weakened and it's like a sort of eroding process. Every time you injure it, it gets a little bit more vulnerable and fragile going forward. And that seems to have happened to Kane. Plus, of course, like he's quite a big guy, Harry Kane. Like he's quite tall, but he's not slender.
He has
so there's
left.
Already quite a lot of stress on the joint. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, so I suppose the conversation I'd like to have here, let's begin this with Tottenham, but let's broaden it out to talk about centre forwards generally, because often you find teams that have the best centre forwards, of course, it goes without saying that they're irreplaceable, right? That's a good thing when they're performing well. When they aren't there, it's a bad thing. Other examples, Jamie Vardy, Sergio Aguero. Starting with Harry Kane, though, and Spurs, we've experienced this problem with this team before, so we have a pretty good idea of what the coaches are going to do to try and make hay during this time. Son Heung-min, obviously, is a player that is likely to step up, if he even needs to step up, already seems to be at the level. But, of course, Spurs will be fine, because they've also got Gareth Bale, and he can play that role, can't he, Seb?
Well, theoretically, Jose Mourinho doesn't seem to want him to play.
No, that was
role.
Just a joke. I'm sorry. I was just trying to make a joke.
I don't have a sense of humour about this. Not like 12 hours has passed since this happened when we're recording. It was recording on Friday morning. So I am still in a fairly angry setting about this.
Let me rephrase then. Okay.
Yes, please do.
I'll make
yes.
less fun, more serious.
Be gentle.
Okay, let me rephrase then. All seriousness, no fun. Carlos Vinicius, I suppose, is the only player who could be a like-for-like replacement for Harry Kane. Are we likely to see him coming into the team, or are we likely to see Mourinho trying to, you know, fix it with some of the adaptable wider forwards that they have?
Well, logically, you'd think yes, because Mourinho made a big song and dance about needing Vinicius in the summer. He almost threatened to get a little bit nasty if he didn't get the player through. Also represented by George Mendes, by the way, incidentally. But he's been very reticent in using him in the Premier League. Vinicius's minutes have generally come in the Europa League or the FA Cup. And it's strange because this eventuality has been kind of inevitable, as we discussed with Kane's injury record. And yet, Vinicius really hasn't been primed to play Premier League football. I think at the time of recording, he's had about, I don't know, 30 Premier League minutes in total. So he's hardly ready to step in. And even at his best, even if he were fully fit and had he played 20 games already this season, he's a different profile and caliber of player to Harry Kane. So he can't fill the role. He can literally fill the shirt and play in that position. But does he provide the same utility to the side? No, and it's not even close. I mean, he's quite an interesting kind of facilitating forward. He's got a nice little range of passes. He's got decent vision. But in terms of kind of caliber of player, that he's nowhere near.
It's quite a funny one, isn't it? The squad building aspect to it, because you'd think obviously having a player like Harry Kane is a net positive thing. He's one of the best strikers in the world, right? But when you have irreplaceable players like that, you always get into struggles. Like let's talk about Jamie Vardy, for example. Like, there is no replacing Jamie Vardy at Leicester. There's not really any hope of trying to bother finding another striker who plays like Jamie Vardy and keeping them on the bench all the time, because you don't have two Jamie Vardys that play alongside each other. When Jamie Vardy is there, your team can do things that they couldn't do without that player and with another striker, and so that is obviously a benefit. But if you build a team around a player who plays in a particular or a unique way, when they disappear, like Firmino at Liverpool as an example, suddenly it can affect more of the team than you would like it to, or it might have done if that striker was more of an ordinary presence. So it's a bit of a double-edged sword, isn't it?
Sure is. With Vardy's a really interesting case, because forgetting his skill set for 1 minute, like I've always thought Vardy has quite a unique attitude towards playing the game. I'm not talking about his off the field personality. I just mean that the kind of the type of person he is on the pitch. He must be horrible to play against. He must be, you know, uniquely aggravating if you're a centre half or if you want time on the ball. And so not only are you trying to replace a player that is very instinctive finisher, lightning quick, but has a quite a unique work ethic actually on the pitch. You're also trying to replace a person, and Vardy occupies a particular place in the game. And so it's really difficult. Yeah, but also like I think over time, it's one of the ironies of the game. Like as a player establishes himself and gets successful and achieves things and plays for his country, like there's an intangible benefit to that player. Like with Kane, a lot of Tottenham players in the past have talked about the difference in the group when Kane is in it and when he's not. It reminds me a little bit of the situation at Manchester United back in the 90s. If you hear or read members of the class of 92 talking about Eric Cantona, it's kind of the same thing. Like on one hand, yeah, you've got all the ability and the goals and the creative aspects of his game, but at the same time, you've also got the personality. And I think you know, Kane is clearly in that category. I'd say Vardy is. Vardy is a Premier League title winner with Leicester, so he's very much a senior member of that Leicester squad. And there are intangible benefits to that, which conversely get lost when the player is absent.
I was actually going to reference Manchester United in the 90s because I'm trying to think of teams that don't struggle when their main forwards are injured or you know have to be replaced. And the team I'm thinking of is the 1999 team, where when you know York and Cole weren't playing, they had Sheringham and Solskjaer, which is I've thought about this for a long time. It's an unbelievable roster of forwards to have, and also not necessarily all the same profile, but you know similar in a sense. Alex, Sergio Aguero is another one of these players, isn't he? You know, he offers something which is slightly intangible to Manchester City, very difficult to replace. In fact, City have a number of players like this. We've noticed it this season with the absence of David Silva, as an example. You can buy players that have similar levels of quality to him, but that not necessarily do, you know, quite the unique thing that he did. Replacing Sergio Aguero is going to be very, very difficult for Guardiola, isn't it?
Yeah, hugely difficult. I mean, I think this is one of the things that is shows why scouting purely based in data is not necessarily the most sensible thing to do, because you can find players that have a statistical match to other players, but like you say, there are these intangible qualities, and sometimes they are to do with imperceptible things, or not imperceptible, but things that are very difficult to measure, like speed of movement, speed of thought. I mean,
grit, you know, desire.
Well, yeah, those things too. I mean, I guess you can probably infer that from watching a player's body language when they're playing. But you know, someone like Vardy just seems to have a gift for how he moves in relation to defenders. Aguero has an innate understanding of the types of balls that are going to be played in. And I think this is why strikers are particularly part of this problem. So obviously you have a set of skills, and some strikers are better at movement, better at finishing, better at heading, whatever, you know, the kind of the end product skills are. But ultimately as well, football is about scoring goals. And everything that a team does is, even defence really, because of transitions, is about getting the ball to that end point. So really, teams are geared in their kind of final evolution to get the ball to a certain player who does a certain type of thing. And that's why you will see teams struggle. This is a thing that Seb mentioned in the last podcast, you know, that there are certain types of runs that if you're the winger or the creative midfielder or the fullback playing with that particular striker regularly, you know that they're going to do that, and also they know that you're going to be able to do that. And that kind of level of understanding, which is predicated on repetition and on building a set of tactics with that individual as a focal point, it's what teams have to do, because otherwise they're not building towards scoring a goal, and there's not really the kind of the direction that makes sense. But at the same time, if they get overly reliant on doing that and don't have the flexibility, then when that player is removed, all of a sudden you've got a striker who doesn't have that instinctive level of understanding, who doesn't know that if they take a step this way and then move at this particular angle, the pass is going to reach them here, and then they have the technical skill to be able to finish that chance. So you can see why the absence of particular strikers makes such a big difference for teams.
Who's the most irreplaceable footballer?
Do you mean ever or currently? Or
I mean currently and in the context of their team. Like maybe Jack Grealish, for example. It could be maybe.
It depends, doesn't it, really? Because what you're looking at there then is the difference between the ability. I mean, I would say Jack Grealish is a phenomenal player, but actually one of the things that Aston Villa have done really, really well this season is to develop other avenues of attack if Grealish is marked out of the game. I think you are looking potentially at someone like Vardy. His ability in the box is so, so good, and the intelligence of his movement, the way that he's adapted his game over time so that, you know, he's gone from, I mean, we did a video on this a while back where he's gone from feeding off a particular kind of long ball or through pass from, for example, a Riyad Mahrez or a Danny Drinkwater into adapting to how Leicester play this more, slightly more patient style of build-up, working with people like James Maddison. You know, that adaptability, again, is incredibly hard to replicate. His movement in the box is incredibly hard to replicate. But then you're also looking at a squad, aren't you? Like you said, with Manchester United, you know, Cole and York were a phenomenal strike partnership. But then in the wings, you had Solskjaer, who was incredibly predatory. You had Sheringham, who was able to drop off and link up play in a way that was different, perhaps, from those other players. So it's also about the flexibility within the squad that allows them to adapt. And maybe Leicester don't have a striker that can play in that same sort of way.
Sheringham got all those fat headers, didn't he? I loved Sheringham's goals because they were all just shit goals, you know? They were all those goals. They're like, striker's bread and butter. Here's the police.
They're taking you away for a truly terrible opinion about Teddy Sheringham.
taking me away for two podcasts.
Rightly so. And they're coming because I called them, to be honest with you. Like, not, as a Tottenham fan,
clarify,
I cannot have that.
Teddy Sheringham's goals weren't all shit. His goals for Manchester United when he was older were all kind of like those doggy goals, you know.
Teddy Sheringham has got some really beautiful goals for Spurs. If you're younger and you don't remember that period of time, go to the old YouTube.
It's possible that people don't remember Teddy Sheringham.
Well, I was going to say, is Sheringham one of those players of incredible quality and also in some ways quite a modern striker because of this ability to drop off, link up play, play other players through?
They called him the Weaver. No, they didn't, but he did a lot of weaving, you know?
Sure. But for some reason, he seems to not be talked about with the same level of reverence as some other players from that era. Which
to
me
to do with his move, though?
I think it's actually might be to do with his longevity, because obviously Sheringham's era involves a really long period of time. Whereas when you talk about the era of someone like Robbie Fowler or Ian Wright, you're referencing quite a narrow epoch. Whereas Sheringham
was nearly 40.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And there were kind of, you know, he was back at Tottenham twice. He was at West Ham. He was at Portsmouth. A lot of Sheringham's qualities were kind of evergreen. So if you look back at the Premier League's history in particular, there are forwards who are associated with a particular time of the competition. So you're thinking about Les Ferdinand, Ian Wright again, you know, Shearer. You know exactly the era that I'm referring to. Whereas Sheringham's abilities are as relevant now as, and you know, would have been as relevant 50 years ago as they were then. Like I think he is underappreciated as a player. I think he also gets lost in that cliche about, oh yeah, the first couple of yards are in the head, because he wasn't that quick. And so you kind of, it's only really when you go back and you watch the things that he did on the pitch that you appreciate what a good player he was. If you missed it first time round, if you didn't get to see him live, then you would. And it's difficult. And it was a phenomenal, the Premier League always has been heavy with like predatory forwards. And so it's easy to miss someone like that, I think.
That's what I've done, Seb. I've missed him. I've painted him as a shit goal scorer.
You have, actually.
You've made me look a fool.
Deliberately so. Like, and you know, the police sirens could not have been, even if Adonis had dubbed that into the podcast after we've recorded it, could not have been more perfect.
Okay.
In fact, Adonis, if there's a way of emphasizing that before we release the pod, that'd be fantastic.
Shots fired. Suspect down. Request EMT immediately.
We'll be back in a minute to talk about wing backs.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Hey, Seb, wingbacks.
Is that just discuss?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, so wingbacks are really interesting because they exist as a tandem, so they're a pair. And at their very, very best, they do work as a tag team, as a genuine combination. The obvious example, of course, is Andy Robertson and Trent Alexander-Arnold. And if you look back across like Liverpool's ascension towards the European Cup and obviously the Premier League title, it's amazing how much of, I suppose, how many attacking gear changes happen at their feet, whether it be, you know, from, a cutting ball, a surging run, or even actually like a switch of play between the two of them. It's an amazing thing to watch. But I mean, I suppose...
Can I stop you and ask a question?
Go on. Of course you can.
When you say wingbacks, what I think is three at the back and wingbacks. But do you just mean fullbacks that are lofty in their advancement of the pitch?
I suppose so. I think I conflate the two now because the modern fullback has a very wingback-like role in terms of kind of the attacking emphasis that's placed on their shoulders.
Absolutely.
So, fullback, wingback. There's a difference in terminology, but today it seems more to refer to the system around them. So you're kind of a wingback if you've got three centre-halves inside you, three central midfielders, that kind of thing. But yeah, where their starting point is kind of seems kind of incidental.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. You know, wingbacks were able to advance high with three at the back as centre-backs because that was a natural affording of cover. One of those centre-backs could pull wide and get into that space behind where the wing-back had advanced. Of course, now with modern full-backs, and Andy Robertson and Trent Alexander-Arnold are a particularly good example of this, partly just their athleticism means that they are able to run up and down though, you know, both flanks of the pitch without needing that additional centre-back as cover. Obviously, if you lose a player like Virgil van Dijk, which is something that we talked about in a video that I think is coming out fairly soon. Coming out on Friday. So, you know, you can go from three to two centre-backs covering, but when one of those centre-backs is of van Dijk's quality, that there's clearly a greater degree of security there. Obviously, there's a knock-on effect there as well when you've got midfielders that have defensive responsibilities dropping back into the back line. And that does, to a degree, thwart the ability of fullbacks to push quite as high. I think what's also interesting is that fullbacks very much work in tandem. And I think, again, the Liverpool pair are a good example of this. And you have two different types. You have fullbacks that both push up really, really high, where, generally speaking, they are looking to work the ball across to one another, or one of those fullbacks is able to make a run inside towards the edge of the area when the other fullback's got the ball. Clearly, the fact that you've got one that's left-footed and one that's right-footed assists this because you can get those nice switches of play while you're moving forward, so everything can be done dynamically. The other type of fullback pairing that we're seeing quite a lot of in the Premier League is where one fullback is the aggressive, pushing up, kind of almost playing as a winger at times, and the other one stays back and tucks inside and makes almost a third centre-back and gives that kind of lopsided position. The point being that these both rely on the fullbacks having a clear understanding of what the other one is doing. And so when one of those players is absent, then that level of understanding, that kind of synchronicity between them both going up to make an attacking front five or one of them holding back to provide cover by tucking inside, that kind of loses something. And so I think here we're talking more about issues affecting a system rather than necessarily the absence of individual quality on that role, although that is also important.
Okay, let's move on to goalkeepers now. Goalkeepers, interesting for two different reasons. I liked what you said, Alex. I just had nothing to add to it.
It was just a brutal cut, but okay.
I was just waiting to see if anybody had anything to say, but nobody did. I think basically that just means you covered it in such elegance and detail that there's really nothing left for me to do. Well done.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Goalkeepers, I'd like to say two different things here with goalkeepers. One, you've got your quality. Two, you've got your type. Am I right? I'm right. One, quality, you know, you lose your number one, you got your number two. Number two's never as good. We all know that to be true. Even the number two, what a difficult psychological position to be in on the bench. Never mind. Two, type. Now, this is where it really gets interesting because I think of goalkeepers like Manuel Neuer or even Alisson at Liverpool who offer something extra and unique, pushing up, being an extra, a passing option, helping the shape of the team. When you lose a player like that, it can really affect absolutely everything about how your team play. Seb.
Sure can, Joe. And I think it's quite interesting to start with that psychological aspect because you listed a couple of goalkeepers there, Neuer, Alisson. Probably you'd add in Edison there, maybe Hugo Lloris at Spurs. Like, these players, if they're not captains of their side, then they have a very specific kind of relationship with the players around them and they have a command over them. Again, let's go back to the well and use 90s Man United as an example. Peter Schmeichel had a strange kind of dominance and relationship with some of his centre-halves. Like, I think... you know, if you listen to Gary Neville speak about the way that Schmeichel used to shout at him during games, like you see a kind of, it is scary, but also it's a dynamic that you just can't replicate. Like back then, if you brought in a Gary Walsh or a Kevin Pilkington, you'd see an effect on a side like Man United that was far greater than just losing the goalkeeper. And I think that's the most damaging thing. Also, Alec, you mentioned like how difficult it is to be a number two at a club, but even if you're not coming off the bench, if you're coming into the team, and generally in that situation, you're coming in after probably not having played a league game for quite a long time. A, you're nervous. B, you're uncertain of all kinds of things, including, you know, the speed of the game, and you don't have the same familiarity with your opponents. You don't know what a forward's traits are, those kind of things. And so you're having to balance that kind of internal personal struggle with obviously your obligation to the side itself. I think it's a really understated substitution.
It's not like, you know, it may be maybe a little winger is clearly the second yeah. choice, but if they're not doing well at 60 minutes, you know, you cuff them and you put your starter on or put somebody else on. That no happen with goalkeeper.
It no happen with goalkeeper, but also like that nippy winger coming on as an impact player. That's a role that he's used to, isn't it? Because that's what he does. Like that's your position at the club. It's your sure. It's part of your job description.
Would you believe me if I told you that I was a goalkeeper, Seb?
Yes, because you're big and loomy. Yes.
No, but for my personality, can you see how it has impacted me as a human being?
Yeah, I can see some crossover there. Yeah.
Well, you're wrong because I was quiet until I was an adult.
See, there's you. I don't feel like that
the way you've said that deserves a sense of victory you've given it. I feel like you've mugged yourself off quite a lot there, actually.
I wasn't a very good goalkeeper. I was just the big, tall guy, you know? Hey, put that guy in the goal. He'll probably block half the goal with his mass, which I did. You know, it wasn't that bad. But Alex, you were a goalkeeper as well, weren't you?
Yes, I was. I was. It's a weird position psychologically. Seb's right.
You're not even that tall. Why were you a goalkeeper?
Because I was lazy and I didn't want to run around.
Yep.
Mostly. And obviously something about the existential angst of the position appealed to me even at a young age.
Seb, what position did you play?
I played in goal.
You also played in goal? Is this a joke?
No. I have a podcast with my old goalkeeping coach. So if you look back in our archives, if you find the Les Cleaveley episode, he came into our school to coach our side. We were very spoiled as amateur schoolboy footballers. But yeah, Les came in and we recounted some of our adventures during that period. But I was, I really struggled because I...
Because you're a paranoid wreck.
Well, exactly. Like, I really struggled with the psychological aspects of it. And it was very trying. And I used to get... a lot of people used to come and watch, and I used to be very afraid of that. And also, when I was 16, I was about, I think, 5'6".
That's not tall enough.
And I used to get knocked about and concussed and, you know...
Although the first ever really great goalkeeper in Russia, Alexei Komich, was only 5'8".
But what was the average height of people during his era? Because that's an interesting little detail. Because the average height of human beings has changed quite dramatically throughout the 20th century.
I'm really bringing the average up, I think.
in any era, you're like a cartoon giant.
Yeah, you are quite tall. Yes.
I'll tell you what you need, gang. Goalkeepers out there. Hey, Seb, some advice for you if you're thinking about getting back into professional goalkeeping. What you really need is confidence. You need hair gel. I think you need a particular, you know, look at the world, the ability to be a libertarian at a moment's notice, but not really. And also you need brute force and aggression and to think that everything you have ever said and done is right, and that other people don't deserve time in your life if they think differently. And if you have those things, I think you could be a professional goalkeeper. Not to say that professional goalkeepers all have those things. Really, it's a joke about me. You know, get it. Do we all get that it's about me?
I think, you know, people were able to untangle that clever web of words.
Yeah. Well, were they? They probably were.
I reckon so.
But anyway, you know, the point of this is to say when you lose a goalkeeper, it's bad, obviously, isn't it? Obviously. I feel like people are going to listen to this bit and go, yeah, obviously. Alex, say something smart with some big words so that people get confused and think we've done something clever.
So there are two types of goalkeeper predominantly. You have the more traditional type that stays back, defends their 6-yard box, doesn't come out too much, and then you have the other more progressive modern type. We sometimes call them sweeper keepers, although there are different types of those. And obviously, if your number two is not the same as your number one in terms of that proactivity, it affects your defensive line position, it affects your ability to build up from the back. So really, even if you take out the fundamentals of being good at taking crosses and stopping shots and shouting at defenders like Peter Schmeichel did, you can literally, just by changing your goalkeeper, adjust your team's position on the pitch by like 5 to 10 meters. And that is an enormous difference and affects every other facet of play, which is why top-level teams, A, spend so much effort on recruiting goalkeepers, but also it's why, you know, Pep Guardiola had the slightly ill-fated Claudio Bravo experiment, because the ability to set the defensive line and play out from the back is considered so important now among a lot of teams. You get interesting exceptions, teams like Atletico Madrid with Jan Oblak and Ivo Gerbic, the understudy there. They're both very much old-school traditional goalkeepers, and there it's much more about shot-stopping, cross-claiming, organising a defence. That's not to say modern goalkeepers don't do that as well, but I think it says a lot that a team will recruit or should recruit a type of goalkeeper predicated on a style of play. And again, understudies are just not going to be as good at that sort of thing, not as commanding. the psychological aspect comes in as well, because if a goalkeeper is a number two, they're going to be less proactive. They'll be more worried about making mistakes because they'll be under the spotlight. I'm thinking of when Adrian had to step in for Alisson and made a couple of high-profile errors with his kicking. So it in some ways, it's possibly, to go back to a question that you asked earlier, the most irreplaceable player in football could be a goalkeeper of that ilk for one of those clubs like a Liverpool or a Man City.
Oh, you answered with style. You have answered with style. Here's a trophy for how well you answered that question, Alex. I hand it to you.
What a lovely trophy that is.
Just to finish, I know I'm breaking the rules of the structure, the theme of this podcast, but something that interested me that I read about yesterday was the multiple reports that Chelsea want to buy Haaland. And talking about irreplaceable players caused me to think of him. Of course, he's irreplaceable. Can somebody just explain to me how he fits with Werner and Havertz and Pulisic and the other one?
He doesn't.
He doesn't really.
So what the fuck?
Because he's the best young striker in the world. So.
So who loses out?
I think particularly because Tuchel has a relationship with Pulisic, may play on the right hand side because he did do that for Tuchel at Dortmund quite a bit. But if he does play on the left, then that's Werner's other natural position. Obviously, Ziyech as well is doing quite well on the right-hand side. So you would be looking... The other big loss would be Tammy Abraham, who I think, you know, if you watched how Chelsea played against Luton and the way that some of those younger players like Abraham, also Billy Gilmore, played, there's a lot of scope to suggest that actually Chelsea should maybe focus a little bit more on developing those guys rather than spending a huge amount of money on a player who's undoubtedly brilliant but will stop the progress of Abraham and also probably force Werner out of the side.
Yeah. I was just curious. One of those ones that made me scratch my head, you know? Oh, one more thing to say. It's fair to say, and I'll ask you, Seb, if you've had any specific feedback, that there was a mixed response to T-Pose. Did anyone say anything specific to you, Seb?
Well, I'm still wading through a sea of messies.
Sure, there's a bit of a delay.
There's been quite a bit of negative reaction to T-Pose.
I should have looked at before. Two people said this to me. As soon as we released the episode, I thought, I'll just put that in Google Translate and see what that means in case I've said something horrific. Haven't. It turns out in Portuguese it means type, and in Spanish it kind of means guy. It's quite masculine. So on that basis, it's not the one for us, I don't think, because it's too exclusive, isn't it? It's too exclusive. There were some other suggestions. I don't know if either of you have any thoughts. I was interested to read. Some people were saying tifosis, but I think that's probably already too much
kind
of a thing.
Kind of taken as well.
Tifoid, but typhoid is no laughing matter.
Tifoid?
Yeah, someone said that. There's other...
Typhoid is no laughing matter.
No, sorry, it's not a laughing matter. Hold on, no laughing at that.
Why do people
maybe there's
need a name, though?
Just for marketing purposes, not for... Because... because it obviously creates a sense of belonging, and it's important culturally, and we can make a lot of money, but it's nice for people.
We can bash them all together and sell them to someone.
But it's good because it brings people on a human level together, and they get to spend time together, and maybe it'll improve their lives, and we'll make a lot of money. And also, it's a nice... It's like... It's something, it's just put, it's doing, going the extra mile for the people who helped us get to the position that we're in, making them feel special, making a lot of money, and just, you know, doing something that's I think, probably on the whole, maybe the most morally positive thing that we would ever do, and making a lot of money. So if you have any thoughts, listeners, you know, do comment below. If you liked Tipo, hey, make a call for it. Maybe you could do. But if there's another name that you, somebody said flutes. I quite like that because of the flute at the beginning. Flutes. What up, flutes?
Maybe Seb should run a Twitter poll. Or maybe listeners should tweet Seb
maybe
suggestions
Alex
that
off.
He could put into his Twitter poll. That might be an idea.
Listen, T-Pos, T-Foses. Hey, listen, guys. Thanks, and gals. Thanks so much for listening to today's episode. I've said this about six times already, but next week is the week that we are moving to a Tuesday and a Friday. So Tuesday stays the same. We'll be going to a Friday. It will give us an opportunity to be able to talk about the most recent things that have actually happened in football and elaborate on it. We're not going to become a match review podcast, but it will just mean that we're not quite so off the pace, off the pulse, off what's happening. We want to know what's happening. Yeah. So we'll be able to do that as of next week. Seb, thanks to you.
Thank you, Joe.
And Alex, thanks to you.
Cheers, Joe.
Thanks to producer Adonis also. And we'll be back on Thursday with something else that is similar to this, but not quite the same, but basically, you know, interchangeable. Bye!
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.